evening, everyone. My name is Ayşe Çubukçu. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and co-director of LSE Human Rights at the London School of Economics. On behalf of the Department of International Relations and LSE Ideas, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the school and introduce our speakers tonight. So we have gathered in this lecture hall today to celebrate the publication of and to discuss the ambitions of Dr. George Lawson's most recent book, Anatomies of Revolution. In an age of uprisings and rebellions around the world, empirical studies of revolution are in fact thriving. Yet, there has been a stall in theories of revolution, which Dr. Lawson's book seeks to remedy by offering a novel account of how revolutions begin, unfold, and sometimes tragically end. By combining insights from international relations, sociology, and global history, Anatomies of Revolution outlines the benefits of what may be called a global historical sociology of revolutionary change, one in which international processes take center stage. Now, before I introduce our speakers, I must mention a few practicalities. First is that this event is a roundtable discussion about Anatomies of Revolution, which is available for purchase, I believe, right outside the theater hall. And there will also be a book signing right after the event. And second, I believe you've been handed out feedback forms by LSE Ideas, which the organizers would kind of like to request that you please fill out. And third and last, allow me to note that this event is being audio recorded, so there will be a podcast of the event, which means that your thoughts on revolution will go down into permanent record. So beware. Tonight we will begin the roundtable with a brief 15-minute introduction by Dr. Lawson himself. As many of you know, he's an associate professor in the Department of International Relations at LSE. Then we will hear reflections from, in order of appearance, Professor Kimberly Hutchings, who is professor of politics and international relations and the head of school at Queen Mary, University of London. Then we'll hear from Professor Mary Caldor, who is director of the Conflict and Civil Society Research Unit at the Department of International Relations at LSE. And then we will hear from Stefan Wald, who's the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. Our roundtable participants will each speak for about 10 minutes before we have a collective discussion, and then I will turn to the audience for your pressing questions about the possibilities and anatomies of revolution today. Without further ado, please join us in welcoming to the world Anatomies of Revolution.
Thank you. Many thanks to Aicha, many thanks to International Relations Department and LSE Ideas, particularly Dora Hegedus, wherever she is, and to the participants for giving up their time so graciously, mainly. And many thanks to you all for coming. It's a full house, which is wonderful to see. We must be onto something. So my book starts with the following sentence. There are two ways of approaching the study of revolution in the contemporary world, and they're both wrong. So I wanted to start by explaining what I mean by that. On the one hand, revolutions appear to be everywhere. On the streets of Hong Kong, of Beirut, of Santiago, in Kobani, in Algeria and Sudan, earlier this year, amidst the Naxalites of central and eastern India and the rhetoric of groups like Black Lives Matter and Extinction Rebellion, in the campaigns of Bernie Sanders and some Brexiteers. You'll notice, by the way, this is completely accidental, the Naxalites pointing their guns on the Brexiteers. But rarely do weeks go by without a revolution of some kind or another being proclaimed. At the same time, it's not just about political movements, it's also about popular culture. We've recently had the hit musical Hamilton, the even more popular Star Wars series that have eulogized revolutionary struggle. And the broadening of the concept of revolution goes beyond its take-up in popular movements and in popular culture. Something I like to do when I travel is I try different domain names of the country that I'm in, and I check out what revolution means in those particular countries. So I thought I'd give you three different illustrations. I'm not going to click on them. You just take my word for them, or you can check up on me if you want. The American version, revolution.com, is a venture capitalist firm. Revolution.co.uk, the British version, is a gaming company. And I had some time in Australia the second half of last year. Revolution.com.au, and this is my favorite one, is a flea and heartworm treatment for dogs and cats. I haven't worked that one out. But the point here is that revolution is effectively everywhere. It's all around us, in popular movements, in popular culture, in pet treatment, and many things besides. So that's one side of the view that I think is wrong, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why it's wrong in a minute. The other side is that effectively the contradictory or the opposite view, the revolution is nowhere. That after the end of state socialism as a major international revolutionary project, what we have in terms of revolutions in the contemporary world are effectively minor disturbances, small R revolutions, rather than these major programs of systemic transformation, deep confrontation, and world order making. And what we're left with, for good or for bad, depending on your viewpoint, it is pale imitation revolutions that can't stand up next to the real, proper, authentic social revolutions that we're familiar with over the preceding couple of centuries or so. So on the one hand, we get revolution is everywhere. On the other hand, we get revolution is nowhere. I set up my book, you won't be surprised to hear, in rejecting both of those positions. The former makes revolution so all-encompassing that it becomes an empty term without substantive content. That's the revolution is everywhere. The latter fails to see the enduring appeal of attempts to overturn existing injustices and generate alternative social orders, hence Beirut, Santiago, and so on. So the primary aim of my book is to generate a more judicious appreciation of the place of revolution in the contemporary world, examining how revolutions emerge, how they unfold, and how they end, tragically or otherwise. Maybe it's always tragically, we can discuss that. So the central task then is to unravel the anatomies of revolution. That's where it gets its title from, looking at these diverse pathways of revolutions and what sense we can make of them. The basic assumption underlying the book is this one, which I think is simple but apparently isn't, which is that revolutions change in form over time and place. That there's not a single template of revolution that you can roll out as if it was a microwave meal that you take off the shelf, pop in the microwave, and 3 minutes later you get something indigestible. The idea is that revolutions change in terms of their meaning, in terms of their actors, in terms of how they're legitimated, and very often in terms of their outcomes. And revolutionary scholarship for too long has singularized revolution behind this model of big R revolution, and it's made a mistake when it's done so, I think, for three different reasons. The first is that we've then picked a handful of cases which we actually surround with more myth than reality. I've always thought it was odd that the social science of revolution was predicated in large measure on the experience of France, a revolution that was first usurped by Napoleon and then overturned by the Bourbons. And that's not a one-off example. There's far more myth than reality when it comes to revolutionary histories, including those that are generative of how we study them. The second problem, I think, is that we focus too much on progressive or self-declared progressive movements. We've missed this radical conservative strand of revolutionary reordering from fascism to militant Salafism. There's some exceptions to this, but the reason that we've excluded them, I think, is more normative or political than scholarly. The third, I think, is that we focus too much on outcomes, that we've often associated revolutions as a shorthand as big transformations, big change. We know them after the fact sometime by how they've ended up. And I think we've got a couple of different problems there. The first is there are far more revolutionary movements that don't generate revolutionary situations, and there are far more revolutionary situations than we have revolutionary outcomes. So what we're doing is cutting off an entire universe of revolutionary stuff from our study by having this definition that rules out a bunch of revolutions as not being worthwhile studying because they don't end the way we think they should. We also therefore miss why lots of those revolutions fail, which is because of successful projects of counter-revolution, the decompress, roll back revolutionary change in various different settings. So we miss a big dynamic there of revolution and counter-revolution, as well as these other problems that I think means that we obscure a whole load of revolutionary stuff, revolutionary experiences, revolutionary dynamics that are fundamental to constructing the type of enterprise I'm interested in doing. So two things then that serve as the dual context for the book, effectively what I wrote it against, what I didn't want to get caught up in. First, this notion in the contemporary world that revolution is everywhere and nowhere. The second, that we have too few cases that we're constructing the study of revolution from, and very often they're more myth than reality. So what I want to do in the remaining time I've got, I guess about 10 minutes, maybe a bit less. Eight is perfect. Just glad you said that. Is talk a bit more about the constructive project, trying to understand a bit more about how revolutions emerge, how they unfold, and how they end. So let me begin at the beginning with the emergence of revolutionary situations. This is the classic definition from Tilly. How do we get to revolutionary situations? I think there are three things that we see as commonly arising when we take this far wider, diverse set of cases, successful and unsuccessful, historical and contemporary, into account. The first is these changing international ties and how important they are at providing a space for revolutionary movements from below to emerge. So we find them deeply associated with inter-imperial rivalry, imperial disintegration. You can go back to the Atlantic Age of Revolutions for one example. Another one at the beginning of the 20th century with the collapse or at least pressures building up on the Ottomans, on the Chinese, on the Russians, on the Persians, and the emergence of constitutional revolutions in those particular spaces. Close association between revolution and war, whether it's the midst of World War I, the obvious example is Russia, or the relationship between small wars and anti-colonial revolutions that you get in the Cold War period. And then you get this shifting notion of client-patron relations, of which the obvious example is Mikhail Gorbachev, recalibrating sovereignty amongst the satellite states of East Central Europe in the mid to late part of the 1980s, removing the Soviet security umbrella from those states, which provides the space for these revolutionary movements from below to actually generate a revolutionary situation. Second notion is regime type, that some regimes are more vulnerable than others to these international ties and their fluctuations, particularly these personalistic regimes that rely on single rulers, particularly when that's aligned with them also being dependent on a foreign backer. Cases of the former, we got France under Louis XVI, Russia under Nicholas II. Once we start aligning that to dependence on a patron, we get the Philippines under Marcos, the Iran under the Shah, Nicaragua under Somoza, Egypt under Mubarak, and so on. And what you have in those cases, why you get that vulnerability, is because when things are going fine, if the state is personified by a particular individual, then that's great when things are going well, but it also becomes hugely vulnerable when things are going badly. It's on you either way. At the same time, these exclusionary regimes effectively turn moderates into radicals because you don't have these intermediary associations that channel grievances and decompress opposition as it arises. Every moment of a fundamental opposition effectively becomes existential. The counter to that is that I don't think you get revolutions in democracy. So apologies for those who would like to see that take place, except when those democracies degenerate, like in the Weimar Republic, and all becoming more personalistic. So you can have your example of Trump there if you like, but I don't think it's going to stand up. So what that finding tells us is that the infrastructural power through society of democratic states that permeate society, civil society, with various different forms of negotiation and decompression are actually far better at preventing revolutionary situations emerging than the despotic personalistic regimes that effectively sit above society where you have these existential forms of crisis, or at least the potential for them. The final thing here I won't dwell upon is just the obvious point that revolutions arise in these moments of systemic crisis that arise from various different places where you get this viable alternative, this anti-coalition that emerges, a popular front that you can unite diverse groups, and I'll talk about that again now. So two different dimensions then to revolutionary events as they unwind. By the way, most people don't talk about revolutionary events or trajectories. They skip from causes to outcomes because the social science of revolutions is so structural that you don't need the bit in the between, but you do. And I'll tell you why in a couple of different reasons. The first is that if you're going to you need the state vulnerability if the state is already opened up to some extent. If the movement has any chance of success, you need to break the claimed hold on the legitimacy of physical force, of coercive power. And for that, you need a state to fracture, and or you need the coercive apparatus to, if not join you, then at least stay neutral, stay out of the way. So an obvious example of success is the Carnation Revolution in 1974, effectively in Portugal, effectively an alliance between radical military officers and popular forces. But if you think about how this works in various other cases, you can see how important this kind of veto power of the coercive apparatus is. Think about
the decisions not to fire on protesters in 1989 in Eastern Central Europe versus the Tiananmen option, or versus what took place in Burma the same year. You might pull apart different trajectories from 2011 the same way, Egypt versus Syria, the kind of stalemate we saw and are seeing in Venezuela, and then the rather, for me at least, sort of tragic story of Hong Kong, where the protesters are effectively doing everything right. But if the state elite won't crack, and if the coercive apparatus stays aligned with the state, and here I mean Beijing, more than the Hong Kong authorities, then it strikes me that the protesters can't win. That you need that movement within the elite, you need that movement within the state for the situation to move you through events towards outcomes. Second is this concentration on revolutionary movements itself. How do you generate from this wide selection of people that protest some type of coherent movement? You do so through the occupation of public spaces. This is the Maidan, the main square in Kiev, in the Euromaidan protest in late 2013, early 2014. You do so through strikes. You do throw through slogans. You do throw through music. You can't have a revolution without music. Music is fundamental. If anyone can find me a revolution without music, I'd be both interested but also kind of appalled. The music is such an important way to kind of overcome fear, channel anger, and foster hope. So what I would concentrate here in this part of the book is much more on social technologies, on stories, on symbols, on chants, on music, than the physical technologies of various kind, including the recent infatuation with social media, that strike me as far more important in generating this notion of we the people. In fact, they do two things. First, they generate this notion of we the people, but secondly, they separate we the people from the regime. That we reoccupy, we recalibrate, we rename this particular public space through our vocabularies, through our slogans, through our music, through our colors, through our chanting, through our occupation, and you separate yourself from the regime, its castles, its palaces, its hills, and all the rest of it. Final point, how we end up in revolutionary outcomes. I'll come to Father Christmas in a minute. Two versions of revolutionary outcomes. First, a kind of short-term one, when you just seize power and the regime is relatively secure. Then this more maximalist version, where you actually institutionalize a whole set of practices, which can take often a generation or so, effectively generate a new framework for historical development. So the combination here of two different things. One is institutional transformation, constitutions, legal codes, forms of redistribution. In the contemporary world, it'd often be forms of liberalization like the shock therapy programs in the 1990s in Central and Eastern Europe. But here again, I want to concentrate on the symbolic transformations, partly because they're not studied so much and partly because they're so fundamental to generating a new revolutionary identity amongst the people. An example here is from Cuba, which for a while after the revolution banned Santa Claus as this imperial alien figure and tried to reconstitute revolutionary identity behind this character of Don Feliciano, who had the revolutionary beard. He had his Guayabera shirt, and I couldn't find a very good picture of Don Feliciano, so I did put Fidel up there, because at least he's got the beard and at least he's got the shirt, right? But you get the point, is that you need this revolutionary identity, these symbols, these forms of ritualization to try and deepen revolutionary sentiment when you're building, you think that you're building a society from scratch. Then you get the international aspect. You get the obvious export of revolution, of which, of course, the Cubans are a very good example. In the 1960s, they provide military assistance to revolutionary groups throughout Latin America. In the 70s, they turn their attention to Africa. 12,000 troops go to Ethiopia. 50,000 troops go to Angola in a mission that lasts over a decade. 1980s, they support revolutionary groups in Nicaragua and El Salvador. In the 90s, they turn to things like the Bolivarian Revolution, instituted by Hugo Chavez. Here's a parade in a march in Caracas, where you get Chavez alongside Fidel and you get Che foregrounded. One reason, by the way, they're not very keen on giving up Maduro today. This is a long-standing form of revolutionary identity that they think is fundamental to securing their own regime. So partly you get the export of revolution through arms and aid. Partly you get it through these other forms of export and emulation around the world. Again, I use the Cuban example to talk about the way that it's secured its position and exported its mission through teachers, through professionals, through engineers, through health professionals throughout the global south, often offered free training in Cuba to many thousands more. So we have a full spectrum program. The revolution doesn't finish the day you seize power. It's an ongoing process of the revolution in the revolution that keeps radicalizing. And that's partly a domestic project and partly an international project, partly about direct export, partly about indirect emulation. All right, final 30 seconds. All right, so what's the goal of the book, and what do I hope I've shown you at least in this vignette? What I'm trying to say is that if we open up revolutionary studies to this broad diversity of experience, historical, contemporary, successful, unsuccessful, we break them down into how they come about, what happens during them, what happens after them, what we see is both attention to the singularity of revolutionary experience, but also patterns that emerge, patterns in history. So we don't have this off-the-shelf version of revolution that we often use, the kind of plug-and-play model of revolution, but we do see something more than just singular experience, something in between. So what I'd like to end with is this visual representation of this, this notion that revolutions don't have uniform structures, but they do have shared forms. So we get the familiar painting by Eugène Delacroix, actually of the 1830 July Revolution in France, liberty leading the people, and it's resplendent, you know, bourgeois patriarchal mode with flag and musket and everything else, and a broadly comparable picture from the Gezi protests in Istanbul in 2013, and I would add a third to this from Palestine late last year in October. And this image, by the way, is a bit of a cautionary tale, as well as I hope trying to get at this notion of shared form and resemblance. It also is something to remind us of the coercive power of revolution. This character here, Ayid Abu Amr, was actually shot by security forces a month after this because this picture was widely circulated. He was then targeted by security services. So again, you get this back and forth between protest and state as the revolution, or at least forms of protest, unwind. So what I'm trying to do in the book is get at these forms of revolutionary struggle, these patterns of history, and these shared patterns that I think we can find from these diverse cases.
Thank you very much, John. Okay. We will begin by Professor Hutchings' reflections.
Thank you, Aisha. Thanks, George, for inviting me to be on this panel. It's a really interesting thing to participate in. Can people hear me okay? Yeah. I'm not an expert on revolutions, but I have been very interested in George's work for quite a long time, and we indeed were talking just before we came in about the inception of this project some years ago. And I think it's important to put the book into perhaps it sort of came up in George's closing comments, but in some ways a slightly bigger context, in that it's a book that is, I think, incredibly valuable for enhancing our understanding of revolutions and is full of lots of amazing, wonderful detail, as well as a big picture account of what's going on. But it's also an exercise in bringing together the disciplines of social science and history, which has been one of George's sort of preoccupations, I think, throughout his intellectual career, as it were. And it's really fascinating to see how he makes that work in relation to this topic of revolution specifically. So I suppose one of the things that really struck me in reading it was how persuasive the critique of the idea of revolution as a category that is somehow static in any sense could work. And also, I think one of the things that's a kind of thematic in the book, although I don't know that you make this explicit, is about the way that revolutionaries theorize revolution also demonstrates similar kinds of issues, in that, you know, some of them are treating it in that way and some of them in a much more open way. I was really fascinated that Luxembourg finally gets quoted in, I think, page 246, and I thought perhaps maybe she could have been there a bit earlier. But that sort of tension between a more static understanding and a more dynamic one, I think, is internal to the revolutionary thinking, as well as to thinking about revolutions by social scientists and by historians. I think there will always still remain the question of that kind of trade-off between description and analysis. I think you do bring it off actually really well, but there is a... I think any historian reading this would want to say, well, yes, but the reward is in the detail of the cases and the ways in which you trace that complexity, Whereas maybe for an international relations theorist or a historical sociologist, it might be much more, well, I really like the earlier chapters that pulled out things like the notion of causal configurations and so on. So I really just throw that out as maybe an issue to discuss, that relationship between analysis and description, between history and social science, which is crucial to the book as a whole. There are four things that I want to say about the book. Two of them very much in kind of admiring mode, and two of them really raising a question, I guess. So
you've only got time for two. Take the last two, yeah.
Time actually is at the issue of the first point. So I thought the account of timing as really crucial was incredibly interesting, and it fits very well with things like Andrew Holmes' work on time and timing in international relations. And I thought it was an interesting sort of issue to put together what you were saying about timing with what the revolutionaries are thinking about time and timing as well. And I would have been interested to hear more about that and how that plays into the causal configurations with which you're concerned at the different stages. But to think about time in terms of timing seemed to me to be a very fruitful and helpful device, and actually one of the strongest elements of the claim for a kind of analytic purchase on the material that you were looking at. So that's one of my admiring comments. A second admiring comment is about violence, nonviolence. So although it's not actually a theme that you're massively foregrounding throughout the text, it seemed to me that you explain very well why and how revolutions and violence are in this very interesting relationship to each other, which does not necessarily mean the terror every time, but always actually replays quite ambiguous relationships between violence and non-violence. And I was thinking about this partly because I'm supervising a PhD student who's looking at the Egyptian revolution and at the way that non-violent activists ended up endorsing violence within that revolution, which I think speaks to that ambivalence and ambiguity around the relationship between violence and non-violence and revolution, which I think you do capture, and again, would be interesting to explore further. Two kind of questions I wanted to raise. One, it's called Anatomies of Revolution, and I was thinking about gender, which doesn't have an entry in the index. And I wanted to ask, I suppose, is revolution gendered, or how do you understand the gendering of revolution in terms of the way that you're trying to think about it? And that partly related to the point about Rosa Luxemburg only coming in on page 246. But clearly there is an important playing out of masculinization and feminization in these processes as well. So I was interested in gender as an analytic category and, in a sense, why it wasn't there.
Yeah.
The other was really a question about normativity. The book's really well written. It's a fantastic read. And particularly in that first chapter, for those of us who are old enough, it calls up just that echo of excitement about the idea of revolutionary change. You know, when people used to sell the socialist worker in the classroom in 1976, you know, those kinds of days. I mean, you raise the question of normativity at the beginning. And I do, there is that sense throughout the book of a certain passion for the passion that fuels revolution, even if it may be a revolution that in many ways is not one that you would sympathize with its aims for. But the idea of major collective action in response to forms of injustice does seem to be a very strong kind of underlying sensibility within the book. So I suppose I also wanted to ask you about how you see the kind of normative position of the author.
Next, we'll hear from Professor Kaldor.
Yeah, well, thank you also for inviting me, and I really enjoyed. As I actually did the book, which I Fred Halliday's book on revolutions, and actually I was telling, I thought, this is, I must look up Fred Halliday's, and the first thing I came up with article on Fred Halliday's book, which I think was the origins of this book. And I particularly like the concept of I thought was really useful and significant. I thought I would do and try to bring to the discussion was which both revolution and war have changed their character in the current period. I thought I'd do that by talking a little bit back. So it's 30 years since 1989. And I think what was new which has hugely, and the other, which I think and that's what I want to talk about. So if we talk about the non-violence, there's a famous article Adam Michnik when he and what he said there was, look, every effort, whether it was 1953 in Germany, 1950 back here, we've always been. And the only way to do it, therefore, was a sort of Gramscian argument to create positions in state. So we need independent universities because collaboration between us. And we've got to refuse that collaboration. And I think those ideas in which he revived the notion of civil society, people don't realize this, but about civil society. And suddenly civil society, it was also used by the Latin Americans, but it was this, expressed that idea. And what you had was a profound instead of wanting to take to the revolutionary movement. I think that was a very big and important shift. There's lots more to be said about it. Now, the second thing that I think is significant rectifying and I remember as somebody who'd been actually rather involved in and I think the ideas were in the place. What the ideas were about was the idea of civil society, the idea of human rights, led to international discourse. They led to both an enormous strengthening of the of course, there were neoliberal ideas too, but I but it also led to this whole new discourse, humanitarianism, civil society, human rights, and a whole new set of practices by both the United Nations. And I think that was the real significance. So that was the 1990s. They were a period when all these ideas were flowering. And then we had a counter-revolutionary period starting with 9/11. And what we got, which I'm not going to go into, but it's what I got, not only the return of geopolitics, but we got and new wars. Fred made in his book and Tilly makes was that in these earlier periods of upheaval associated with war, and war played a profoundly important role in constructing and in restructuring states, and that was how you got a sort of social adjustment and reorganizing the world order. Contemporary wars are completely oppression, and actually they lead to the Saskia Sassen calls the disassembly of states. And so that this counter-revolutionary tendency so now I'm not going to George is right to point at that we're experiencing. And one is the emancipation. Social justice, climate, gender issues. By the way, actually, I just wanted to add that. And that if you look at the 2011 one now in Lebanon, gender has been a really. But anyway, that's just an aside. So that's one direction. And of course, the other direction, as George points out. And I think the latter's success will. Perfectly possible. I think George points out that contemporary revolutions have been remarkably unsuccessful. I'm talking about post-89. I think one of the reasons is they don't have that international, they have intersocial dimensions, but they don't have international, they don't address international issues. I mean, I think in 1989 it was spread of international law. Space. And that no longer exists. Because so I just don't think, unless, and I also think that they suffer from what George. If revolutions are focused on the state and not international arrangements, I don't think they can succeed because, if you like, the trans-social, you know, all our problems cross borders, and we can't solve them. So even when you get a successful revolution, without some kind of new set of global arrangements, they're doomed. So I just think that's what's kind of new, that actually you're quite right, absolutely right, that the failure to separate the international. But actually that is the only revolution, emancipatory revolution.
Thank you. Hey, you might be here all night.
I'm fine with that.
Okay. Next, we have Professor Wong.
Great. So I'm delighted to be here to talk about this book because I really had a great time reading it. And for the next 10 minutes or so, I'll be playing the role of the crude North American positivist because someone has to. This is a great book. First of all, it's a hugely ambitious book because it's really got two targets, right? One is the enormous literature that's been written about revolutions, and the second target is the historical record and how we understand that. So he's really wrestling with two formidable adversaries at once, and that's not hard to do. Also, as has already been said, the book is extremely well written, even though he is dealing with some pretty thorny, abstract concepts. I think there are a few passages where that challenge actually defeats you, but he has worked incredibly hard to make this as clear as possible, and that's something we should all be grateful for. I wish more people would do that. There is a lot here to like, and the nicest thing I can say about the book is, henceforth, you will not be a literate person on the subject of revolution if you haven't read this book, full stop. It's going to become part of, I think, the mandatory reading list. So now let me just raise some questions about it. What? So the first issue I want to raise is I had some trouble figuring out what the question was, not so much what the answer was, what the question was. You said that your goal is to develop ideotypical accounts of revolutionary situations, trajectories, and outcomes. But what's the broader question for which that is the answer? Right, you're not trying to explain why revolutions happen in the sort of old-fashioned social science way. At least I don't think so. You're trying to get us, and I think successfully, to see revolutions less as discrete events with a sort of unifying general cause and more as complex processes that are situated in specific places, specific historical contexts. In other words, to historicize them. But I want you to say a little bit more about what the actual purpose was. What was the question? Second, is this argument a falsifiable argument in the sort of classic Popperian sense? I'm at the LSE. I've got to bring up Popper. So there's not a simple theory here the way other theorists of revolution have advanced one. Not saying they're right, by the way. Instead of sort of a clear cause and effect relationship like Theda Skocpol would try to give you or Ted Gurr or many others, you see revolutions as contextually specific event complexes produced by configurations of different developments happening in different places. So the question is, what sort of empirical developments would lead us to question and maybe even reject this framework? There are lots of different ways that revolutions, lots of different forms that revolutions can take. That's one of the key arguments of the book. So the question is, looking forward, what sorts of political events would lead you to want to revise this framework? A real revolution in a real democracy, would that do it? Something like that. Similarly, looking backwards, if we learned more about some past revolution, new evidence came to light of one form or another, what sorts of things about France or Russia or Iran or whatever would lead us to want to revise this framework? To what extent would it be susceptible to modification in light of new evidence? I want to say a little bit more about this. One of the contributions of the book is this concept of the intersocial. And in particular, he uses that term to get away from talking about just interstate or international processes. So from a sociological perspective, that makes perfect sense. But the problem is the category intersocial includes just about anything happening anywhere outside the boundaries of the particular state where the revolution might be taking place. Right? It could be the flow of revolutionary ideas and literature, songs, direct military aid from a revolutionary power to some sympathizers someplace else, a counter-revolutionary intervention from abroad that radicalizes the revolution, an economic downturn globally that creates conditions for a revolutionary crisis. In other words, almost anything can be intersocial. And when you get a category that is that broad, it starts to lose some analytic bite. Almost any event could be put in there, but it's not quite clear if it belongs. Third big point, case selection. I'm going to only talk about a couple of things here. What about revolutions from above, right? The Ataturk Revolution in Turkey, or even the Nazi seizure of power, the Gleichschaltung in Germany. These events don't really fit the model. Vast social change is being directed by the state, which is not being challenged by anyone at that point. The security forces are lined up behind the state. Their loyalty is assured. And there's no independent social mobilization in Germany after 1933 or in Turkey once Ataturk has taken power. Yet the impact on those societies is profound. So where do revolutions from above fit in there? And then second, just to be a little bit provocative, the Velvet Revolutions and the Color Revolutions in Eastern Europe. I mean, they're a very odd form of revolution because the states in which they occurred were to some degree artificial creations of an external power, the Soviet Union. And once the Soviet Union was no longer willing to intervene and prop up, these regimes collapsed rather quickly, right? You could even argue that places like Poland and Hungary are now reverting back to some deeper cultural traits, right? I don't want to push that too hard, but to what extent were those real revolutions at all, regardless of how many wonderful ideas were flowing around in 1989? Last set of points. I cannot resist the temptation to ask George to apply this to even more recent events. What does your understanding of revolutions tell us about what's happening in Hong Kong? Is the psychotic episode that the British political system currently undergoing one where many political norms are being violated or challenged? Is this a precursor to something that might be called a revolution if it led to the breakup of the United Kingdom into constituent parts? Would that be a revolution? What about the constitutional crisis in my own country, right, where the sitting president has hinted that his supporters might intervene with violence to keep him in power if he's voted out? That suggests a certain challenge to prevailing norms. What about Bernie Sanders, who says he wants a revolution? If he wins and provides health care for all, free college tuition, and a really more progressive tax system, is that a revolution? Finally, what do you make of the right-wing nationalist internationale that unites Poland, Hungary, Turkey, the Philippines, Russia, maybe Trumpians, and a handful of Brexiteers as well, marching under the banner of Steve Bannon? What does this framework tell us about those events, or do they fall short of a revolutionary situation? Now, lastly, I teach in a school of public policy, and I've always thought we intellectuals had a responsibility to try and use our work to try and make the world a better place in various ways. So this is an unfair question, but what are the practical lessons that a sitting policymaker should take from this book? Other works on revolution have tried to offer prescriptions of one kind or another, possibly unsuccessfully. But the unfair question is, if Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn or Nicola Sturgeon called you up and said, "What does your book tell me that will allow me to govern more effectively?" what would you say? Or would you just say, "That wasn't my objective at all, you're on your own"? All right. Now again, those are some of the issues that occurred to me as I read the book, but I just want to emphasize again, I got enormous pleasure out of reading this book. It's a really terrific intellectual achievement. You should be really proud, and so should the LSE.
Turn to George for comments for about 5 minutes, and or we can have a collect. Sorry. Okay. And then please feel free to contribute.
Why don't I look at gender normativity and then some issues here around contemporary events? And I just want to note that the point about gender that Kim raised and then Mary raised in passing is, I think, for me at least, the biggest gap in the book. And it wasn't one that I was unreflective about. I just couldn't work out what to do. So the obvious story when it comes to gender and revolution is that women, of course, and gender are there all the way through. So the basic line would be women are always present during revolutionary struggles, sometimes more or less explicitly. So you'll have 30% of the Sandinistas. Otherwise, they're there on the streets in 2011 in particular, and I deliberately put up some pictures of women for Sudan, so on. So we know that they're there, and then they're always written out of the story about how progressive the revolution is. So sometimes on the back of some legislation, which now says, "Can you go home?" Not, but always written out of the story one way or the other. So we have Luxembourg, we have Celia Sanchez, but the bigger story of gender just is yet to be written, and I didn't write it. Someone should. Whether that's me, I say it, and my students will testify every year in the revolutions class. Do I not say that? Or have I not yet? I do. Thank you. And I will continue to do so. It might be me, it might be someone else, but it remains to be done. The normativity is a basic ambiguity, right?
line, I think, in the introduction, which I won't remember, about revolutions being tragic necessities and necessarily tragic. And that's effectively where I've got to. You know, slavery is not abolished because slaveholders want it to be. Eyes don't disintegrate because they're never a top-down in their entirety, no matter how many times we're told that they are. And yet, we know that the outcome is bloody and a long way away from what they were. We can talk about, I think, some reason. I think what's interesting is actually the normativity of contemporary revolutions, this new model from 89 on, which I think we're only just starting to unpack, which is almost the opposite. If the ambiguity about the normativity of social revolutions was the fact that they confronted the social question, that the idea was to remake society within the revolution, as Fidel puts it, everything in the revolution, nothing outside the revolution. Everything is now a totalizing script, and that did have terroristic dimensions to it, then you have the opposite issue with the more negotiated, pacted 89 revolutions, which I've called in the book the moderation curse, which is there's so much negotiation, there's so much weighing of different sides. Fred always would laugh at me saying, you think you can have a revolution with no losers? That there's a sense to which we can do this together. You know, you can overcome structural problems of this order by negotiating your way through them, by just being nice, by playwrights being presidents. And 30 years on, we know that's not right, or at least we know that there are problems that are submerged that then reoccur. I don't think it's all
for when they're violent and terrorist.
I know. And we know we've got a good sort of normative basis for studying that. By the way, there is no tradition. Another one I like to tell the students, someone should do, you know, a project in just revolution. You know, there's all of that stuff on just war. You know, when is it just to rise? What's just during it? What's just after? The sort of just revolution tradition, it strikes me, is not well done. But my version of this is that we're pretty far on in terms of exploring the normativity of social revolutions and really not so much developed when it comes to thinking about the new model of revolutions, particularly that notion of the moderation curse and what happens when you shift from the social questions, more pacted issues of political representation and all the rest of it. Those movements, by the way, you know, that they deliberately self-limiting. That's the other way of thinking. That wasn't Habermas, was it? Who was the self-limiting?
It wasn't Conrad, because Conrad just...
Anyway, this notion of the contained, sort of self-limiting, sort of normalizing, rectifying, a revolution, you know, it's there from the beginning, partly in their organizational apparatus, the lack of violence, the explicit rejection of violence, the enormous movements that then are generated. Steve's colleague, Erica Chenoweth, is very good at charting how that generates a low entry bar for people to join a protest, because you're not being told you're going to throw weapons today or take up arms, you're going to take part in a mass demonstration, you're going to occupy, you're going to break the law, but you're not going to do so in a way that is immediately threatening to your body and all the rest of it. But that means they're already finding it harder to win afterwards in a way that would generate that type of structural transformation, because there's so many more of them and they're so much more diverse. So what happens afterwards, once the revolution, these huge anti-coalitions fracture, is you get ongoing negotiations, or sometimes you get the restoration of old politics rather than the seizing of power by a particular revolutionary vanguard that then issues the emergence of a particular new system. So the normativity shifts, it's always there, and I'm always ambiguous, I'm just ambiguous in a different way. Final thing, I mean, the project is all about revisions, in that one thing I do in the book is I had my first project was on the 89 revolutions and trying to think about them beyond the region in a slightly more global way. And I tried to revise that as I go, in saying, look, there were five things that I thought about, the model of which only a couple are still there, a couple are still underway, and a couple are being changed. There's a sort of 2.0 model, which I talk about, which I won't talk about now, but that's a version of revising the work as I go, that it strikes me this kind of approach is actually pretty good at. I found myself, I was telling characters here that I did a talk at Oxford last week, and I was accused of being too predictive. And I realized that actually, you know, we're all, at least a lot of us, are quite predictive without necessarily knowing it. So one thing that's emerged from this, although in a very different way than a particular type of positive enterprise would work, is that I think the Hong Kong protesters will lose. They will lose regardless of their strength and regardless of their adaptation and regardless of their numbers and regardless of their durability, unless there's a fracturing of the elite, and the coercive apparatus stays out of it enough to allow their particular moral force and energy and numbers to win. And that's something that occurred, you know, during the course of the book. I don't know if it's falsifiable or not, but if they won, I'd have to develop the ideas or maybe junk them. And it's the same type of idea we could talk about Brexit and the US as well. I was surprised. I mean, as the world becomes more personalistic, you know, the rest of it, those states are actually becoming more vulnerable. You know, they're actually backed up in this kind of vertical, despotic, personalized way. They often look like they're stronger because they're armed to the teeth and they parade in military uniforms and they have these macho YouTube videos and all the rest of it. But actually, they're making themselves more vulnerable because they're excluding more people. They're turning moderates into radicals. They're making themselves far more accountable for everything that happens, including things that go wrong. And they don't have these forms of transmission between state and society that act to decompress revolutionary challenges and opposition. They emerge. So I surprised myself in the capacity. I wouldn't use the same language, but stuff that comes out of it that I strike me is some way short of a general model, but has these kind of shared forms, exactly the type of thing I'm trying to get at.
I know you have much more to say.
No, that's it.
Well, I would like to begin the Q&A by my own question, if you don't mind. About the predictive nature, in your conclusions, at some point you state revolutionary movements must be international or they will be nothing.
Oh.
Right. So I want to bring in the question of the international and internationalism. Raise it because there seems to be a tension. On the one hand, this is an internationalist account. On the other hand, you're structurally so focused on taking state power as far as the definitions and markers of revolutionary situations go. So how does one have a world revolution in this, or what is the international or internationalism at stake if, by definition, we should be focused on the seizure of state power? You do recognize and acknowledge other theories, call them postmodern, I think. Theories of revolution, like John Holloway's work, yeah. Change the World Without Taking Power, etc. And Hart and Negri and others who are trying to theorize the possibilities of revolution in the 21st century. So I was hoping you would comment on that tension.
That gets actually to one of Mary's good points that I didn't talk about how much this new model shifts understanding of international. Okay. One of the big shifts, it strikes me, in contemporary revolutions is that revolutions, one strand of them, probably the predominant strand of them, are actually about joining in national order, sometimes strengthening it, rather than offering a systemic alternative. And like forms of republican constitutionalism did, what did these states want to do? Join NATO, join the European Union if they reinvigorate this whole notion of Central Europe that makes it an accident they were ever not within a particular type of a Western project. Here it really was an alien outside force that simply stopped their own natural historical development. And in many ways, that is still an aspect of where we are. But we also have a couple of other things Harry mentioned and you mentioned, Aicha, that are really important. One is that there's an older notion of revolution that says if we can't find any friends, we're going to lose. I mean, that's a slightly more regional issue. But the older notion that the Soviets, the Russians had, the Soviets and all the rest of it was, you know, unless we can find some allies, particularly a powerful state, then we're going to be buried. Sometimes they were and sometimes they weren't, interestingly enough. The Tunisians, you're right, hemmed in, not just because there aren't successful states around them in terms of the 2011 uprisings, but also in terms of international order. I think what there's been has been a sort of splitting of the social and the political. But because revolutionaries these days, for example, in Tunisia or Egypt, haven't got a different type of model, they haven't got a different type of answer to the social question. They bear a political representation. They still have a notion of social justice, but it's a much more limited one than the socialist one and aspects of the post-colonial one, the constitutionalist one. They're hemming themselves in, as well as the fact that they don't have regional friends and as well as the fact that they don't offer this systemic alternative to international order more generally. So there's a really curious back and forth going on about international order. The ones that do so are the ones that are either limited regionally, the sort of militant caliphist version, or at least limited in terms of how far that could go, or that could offer a different type of rendering of international order, a different conception of territoriality, a different vision of what political order and social order is supposed to look like in those particular settings, and then some of these more personalistic characters as well, depending on how far they think they can push that particular model. So there's something going on here about these two modes of revolution, one supporting existing international order, one, I think, challenging it, which both speaks to previous revolutionary models and also offers something different. It's one thing on the Hart and Negri one. I mean, one thing that's happened, I think, with the Hart and Negri version, which has happened to some of the characters who is they turned around and said, we actually need a theory of state power. One of the problems we had is thinking that because power is so rhizomatic and so dispersed, that the revolutionary multitude would sort of organically arise in all of these different settings. And, you know, Mika White's book on Occupy in 2011 said we should have had a theory of the state. We should have had some notion of what we were supposed to do with politics, because when the coercive apparatus of the state turned upon us, we just, you know, we had no answer. So I think there's always this wrestling with the state as both a necessary vehicle of revolutionary projects, but never the sufficient end of the revolutionary project. There is no revolutionary that thinks that the state is its limit. It always seeks to project its power abroad, partly because they think they'll lose if they don't, partly because they think they have lessons for others. They have proselytizing visions that cross borders. But I think what's interesting about that twist, whatever we want to call the Hart and Negri sort of more anarchist sort of version of it, is that it's actually had to come to terms with state power and political power and how that's to be oriented, a bit like Marxists and anti-colonial figures did previously, which said, at the very least, this is a stepping stone. We seize power here, and then tomorrow, there, and the day after, there. So I think that interplay is back in a way that is really quite important.
I just wanted to ask you a question. Just what are your intuitions tell you about the prospects of a sort of a genuinely effective revolutionary ideology reemerging someplace? When Fukuyama wrote The End of History, I thought that was an absolutely crazy idea. Humans were far too creative to be happy with liberal democratic capitalism from now until the end of time, that eventually people would be upset by it and they would start developing new ideas, new amalgams they'd pull on various things. And I think we've seen two candidates, both of them I think ultimately will be unsuccessful, but two candidates for that. One is, let's say, the revolutionary ideology represented by ISIS, based primarily on religion, wants to transform the international system in all sorts of fundamental ways, very different set of ideas. And the other is, call it the intellectual ferment that is right-wing nationalist thinking now, replacement theory, very populist in orientation, very retrograde, often quite racist, anti-Semitic, etc. But those are the two places where you see real ideas being generated. Not ideas I'm wild about, by the way, but ideas being generated. So the question, none of them, I think, will catch on in a big way and constitute something like Marxism once constituted. But the question is, what are the prospects that somebody will come up with the magic amalgam that does start to suddenly get lots of people in lots of places around the world to go, yeah, that sounds pretty good. I could get behind that.
That's what we know, is that these new ideas, exactly, I think you described them exactly right, as amalgams do appear. I mean, it strikes me there are three strands in the contemporary world, right? I mean, one is liberal revolution, which, you know, is what the Hong Kong protests are about, and to an extent what Sudan is about, and aspects of Venezuela are about, and aspects of Lebanon are about. We forget that the 89 example isn't the only one, but, you know, once upon a time, that was the preeminent, you know, revolutionary current to fight against absolutism and to fight against particular types of imperial domination. So that strikes me as an available current. I mean, it's not world remaking in some ways, unless liberal international order really collapses, but it is something that's an international project. You're right. I mean, militant Salafism, parts of populism, I totally agree about the right wing transnational. I think and remember, there are parts of that where that comes together that are far more revolutionary than the Trump version or the Anglo-American. People like Duterte are fundamentally extra-constitutional out carrying out this particular project. It doesn't actually have an international mission in that regard, but it is drawing on this intersocial order to generate fundamental social transformation at home, partly from the top. The third one, I guess, which I leave open to people, the return of socialism. Slightly different guys. I mean, I'm pretty surprised to find socialism arrived in a moment of great late development at last in the United States. You know, there it is. The Corbyn agenda here is interesting. When you move away from Brexit, anyone paid attention to the last Labour conference would have seen an extreme. And it will be within constitutional, so not revolutionary. It'll be something conducted by a particular political party, but it is not afraid to ally socialism with lots of contemporary automation, Green New Deal, an amalgam there of a really interesting, advanced, forward-looking socialism that we're seeing around many parts of Europe and the Americas and beyond.
I agree with that. It's not possible in one country. That's what makes revolutions different.
Right.
And that's where I'd right. come back to both you and Stephen, the 1989 revolution. I was trying to say, and maybe didn't get across, the way in which international, instead of being about old-fashioned geopolitics, about having much more effective markets, about having international law. And those were new ideas that but that people just don't see them. I mean, they came out of the whole, and they came out partly because the they all gained a lot from the kind of laws that had been that helped to create space and put pressure on the coercive apparatus. So what I'm really trying to say is that, you know, if you had a similar situation, and you did, instead of having China outside, you had a system of international set of sympathetic, you know, it would change the whole, and you can't succeed without that framework, but you also have to have a program that's global, and that's what the new transformation is about. I mean, I agree absolutely with what you said. Has to also have.
I would like to turn to the audience. All men, I know. Right, yes.
Hi. I would like to know from any of the speakers, what changed your mind when reading or writing this book? What did you change your mind about?
One more question.
When I last studied revolution at the end of the 1960s, I can remember concluding that, well, there were lots of revolutionary forces around the world the whole time. And the really interesting question, what you need to have a successful revolution is you need to have the collapse of power. And the really interesting question was what makes power collapse. And therefore, for example, the revolutions of 1989, what caused those? It's easy. Gorbachev. Now, and in other cases, it's wars. But the critical question is, why does power collapse? Maybe there are times when the revolutionaries can help it, but often it does it on its own.
I'd like to urge students and women to...
Down far end.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
No. Thank you. That was really interesting. I guess I had a question about the imagery she talked about. I was really, I'm a historian of the Nicaraguan Revolution, so music and symbols played a very powerful role. And I kind of wondered if you could speak a bit more about the target audiences of these imageries, both national and within the region, but also international, and how these influenced the trajectory of revolutions both before and after the revolution's triumph?
Hi, it's a very simple question, but what exactly makes a movement a revolution? I mean, where do we draw the line and say that's a revolution, that's not? Like, why can we say that some things, or like, why Hong Kong is a revolution, why some things are, like, what is the bottom line to say that is a revolution? Is it by the outcomes, the claims?
On this last one, I don't think you can draw the line. At least one of the points of trying to write the book is saying that you can't draw the line. I think we've made a mistake doing that for too long, in thinking that you'll know at some magic point, I'm not quite clear when, 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, 30 years down the line, that we have sufficient transformation to say that's a revolution with a capital R and this other stuff wasn't. I think what you do if you seek to draw a really hard line in the sand of some big R revolutionary studies is you miss all of this other revolutionary stuff that looks a bit like revolutions and a lot of stuff that failed. So Steve asked, what was the question animating the book? That was probably my first fundamental question, is then what happens when you open up? So the answer to that then is you could just open up completely. And in many ways, that's what has happened to revolutionary studies in the broader academy, that it's got dissolved into civil disobedience studies. So, and this partly links to what was my surprise. I very gradually thought that won't do either. So what we need is a kind of dotted line. We need to both connect revolution to these other forms of protest and contentious politics and reserve a kind of relative autonomy from it. And you need a sort of set of provisional judgments as you go. So in your Hong Kong example, I don't doubt that is an attempt to generate a revolution in that particular place, and that fulfills what I would consider to be fundamental, extra-constitutional, mass, rapid, et cetera, sort of forceful attempt. I don't think they're going to win, but I think it would be very odd if they say, oh, after the fact, you weren't revolutionary, even though you attempted that because you didn't win. So mine is a sort of hedging, which I think a lot of people would find unsatisfying, that I'm trying to open up, but not to the extent of saying everything in the world is revolution, just because you call yourself, you know, all of us in this room suddenly decide we're a revolutionary movement. I mean, we can if you like. But I don't think that's going to work, right, unless we've got our program and all the rest of it. So somewhere between the everything and nowhere is this kind of dotted line that I think you have to remain open to, because revolution changes, according to history theory practice, that gives us a relative autonomy for revolution in relation to these other forms of contentious politics, but not one that's so distant that we only know it a long time after. So that's got two of them. Can I just do the sort of symbolic one?
Yeah.
I think I've become increasingly interested by that. I'm not sure I changed my mind on it, but increasingly interested. I mean, once upon a time, I mean, it partly gets to the sort of media question. And I think it's partly because I think of 2011 as a bit of sort of blessing and a curse for revolutionary studies. And a lot more people are interested again. Great. A lot of people think that revolutions began in 2011. Bad. So part of it, and that gets wrapped up through questions like, these are social media revolution. So the only form of revolution you can have in the contemporary world is one adopted through social media. And obviously revolutions have spread before now, and they've done so by ship or by, you know, carriage or railway or word of mouth or all the rest of it. But there were always these objects that served as forms of symbolic identification. Uniforms, fatigues, right? The guerrillas. I mean, you know, the Cubans were fantastic at this, right? When would Fidel ever get a picture taken of him, you know, without his very particular pose that helped, and, you know, he got written up very nicely in the New York Times, which helped sell him as this sort of nationalist crusader to an American audience, which was particularly powerful. It's obviously become much more visual as we've become a much more visual age. There's also, I think part of it is that it spreads because people emulate it. If it happened there, it can happen here. So let's copy them, right? Colors, slogans, music, chants, occupations, demonstrations, strikes, this kind of common repertoire. And partly they adapt at the same time. So there is a kind of new model of revolution that has spread, sometimes by emulation, sometimes deliberately. There are lots of people around the world who are spreading people power in the same way that communists spread models of vanguardism and revolutionaries in the Third World spread models of vanguardism. So I think it's always this relationship between international and the local. Something has to resonate in a particular space, but it's always traveling as it goes. I mean, the obvious example is someone like Che, right, who, you know, has this sort of David Beckham dimension to him on the one level, but also has a very particular resonance on the other. And himself has got this kind of intersocial dimension to it. That on the one hand, you know, is this sort of archetypal revolutionary figure that spreads far and wide, and in some senses, sort of everyday sort of international figure himself, which I didn't realize until recently. The Irish state issued a commemorative stamp in 2017 to mark the 50th anniversary of his death, partly for political reasons which we won't go into, and it caused a great ruckus in Ireland, partly because part of Che's family was Irish, that his dad's name was still Lynch. And so, you know, you had this Irish family went over to Spain or Portugal, traveled over to Argentina, went over to Cuba. He gives you that story of these revolutionary characters, you know, moving across borders, seeing their revolutions necessarily always international. So I think there's lots of different dimensions to it, but the one I'd want to highlight for you is A, becoming more visual, but it doesn't mean, you know, we've never had these capacity to spread messages, and B, the way that we've always connected international, transnational stuff with local forms of iconography to make them resonant in a particular place.
I wanted actually to address Robert's when does power collapse? I think the Gorbachev phenomenon. I think the defeat is incredibly demoralized. I think growing corruption was hugely. And, you know, the more I think about it, the more I realize their economic reform. They had political positions. And they saw a chance that's exactly what happened. So that would be my answer in the 1989 case. And how would I generalize this? Well, I think that nonviolence is maybe more moderate. Everybody, because these changes in ideas have reached up to the top. And it's fascinating if you look at Spain is a country where there's active civil society. Realize that changing regimes make absolutely no difference. That's why we're all engaged. And so I actually think this sort of
yes.
There is a microphone. Okay. The question is, we mentioned a little bit about the prospects of revolution in the current day and age. My question is about how has technology contributed or hampered the prospects of revolution in current age, as we see, we talked about this we feeling that's been mentioned, but also the fact that a lot of technologies are being used by states, for example, to better monitor feelings of dissent. So how do you think technology is going to play out in the coming, say, decade or even
And how, hello, and how these revolutionary waves cause revolutions to take control of states and then try and export the revolutions abroad. Could you talk about a little bit when the wave sort of recedes and you have some holdouts that still have the revolutionary mentality? You think about countries like Cuba and Iran, where they still have these mentalities, but they're becoming increasingly isolated. Is there then an inter-societal shift that pressures them to conform with the international system? How would you explain their situations and their trajectories?
Thanks. Great panel, great book. Two quick questions. One of them is probably not going to surprise you. So I think the big missing piece in the book is sort of a thorough discussion of colonialism and empire, which is, as I said, not going to surprise you. But I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about colonial revolutions as either fundamentally different or not different from other revolutions, specifically because the kind of elite fracture you're talking about is not a fracture in the place of the revolution, but in Hong Kong's case, it's a fracture in Beijing, and in Haiti's case, it's sort of a fracture in Paris that needs to take place for the revolution to really be successful, right? So is there something fundamentally different about colonial revolts? The second one is something that came out of your discussion. So you talked about the low cost of entry for modern day civil disobedience movements and mass protests and kind of the literature that comes out of the social movement stuff, especially post 2008, right? It strikes me that a lot of the lessons, which are actually sold as lessons essentially for protest movements and potential revolutionaries, are very specific to protest in modern democracies. And I'm wondering if those are transportable to any kind of authoritarian regimes, right? Because it's not a low cost of entry if even a civil disobedience protest is going to cost you 10 years in jail in Hong Kong, or if it's going to cost you a bullet in Iraq, right? So is there a problem with the change in the revolution's literature towards social movement stuff that really is taken from empirical realities on the ground in D.C. or Baltimore?
Last question.
And very likely to go down to defeat. So the question is, does that matter? I mean, I've met very few Hong Kong Democrats who expect to win, but yet we see this huge social breakdown in Hong Kong society. And my second question is, how important do you see nationalism and national identity to the 1989 moment? So there's this comment we have in 1989 that I think it was Havel said it at a meeting that Mary was at, actually, that civil society is now in power, but they were in power in nation states, and they found as political actors, it was actually quite convenient for them to shock horror, start mobilizing national ideology. And that seems to be such an important part of the longer term trajectory that we see in Europe, where the Europeanness of the civil society movement gives way to the nationness, in Anderson's term, of what comes after.
We have 5 minutes to... I will open it up to all our panelists.
I'm ready to answer the question on nationalism. Mm-hmm. I don't think it... You know, I think the nationalism... by and large, a counter-reaction. This isn't nationalistic elements. But actually, if you look and it was a new way, nationalism was a way of retain power. That was the case in the Balkans. That's been the case in Ukraine, where nationalist rhetoric has been a
way. I'll just dovetail on it. I think there's a connection between the question that was asked about the relation of colonialism and empire to the question of nationalism. I think one of the things we are learning now is in this part of human history is that nationalism really does have enormous staying power, enormous stickiness. It's very hard to transcend it. It comes back out every time you see a people, you know, in changed circumstances. And we're getting lots of reminders of what happens to peoples with a collective identity who, say, don't have their own state, have not been able to pursue a nationalist agenda. Just look at the Kurds. Look at the Palestinians. That turns out to be a very delicate position to be in. So anybody who thinks that any kind of revolutionary change is likely to transcend nationalism anytime soon, I think, is likely to be disappointed.
Just following on from that, I think the relationship between the nation and the state that's crucial there. So how much is nationalism actually symbolic product of the fact that in order to leverage change, the state has apparatuses that are incredibly useful. So there's something there about how you enable change. And that's actually something that's in the book very much, I think. Ways in which the state is part of this story, but is also always being transcended. But it does seem to me it's a really crucial question as to where that purchase of nationalism comes from. Right. And I think the relationship.
Last word.
No, I'll do something else. Just on Luke's question, because the bigger one lurking within the Hong Kong question is what does revolutionary success and failure even look like, right? And I think you're absolutely right amongst the protesters. And we've been here before. You know, 1848 fails as a wave. But democratization, if that's broadly what that was about, and nationalism, don't go away. The same with the constitutional revolutions at the beginning of the 20th century. The relationship here between success and failure, I think, is actually quite an interesting one, not least because as well as there being a sort of temporal unwinding to some extent of when we might think about success and failure, we also get this issue of direct and indirect. So, for example, lots of states, in order to prevent revolution happening there, do a lot of reform. You know, Bismarck introduces social insurance, not because he wants to, but because he's worried that otherwise he's going to get swept away. So I think your point is a really good one about success, failure, direct, indirect, and this often taking place over very long terms, which is one reason why judgments look so different as to when you look at revolutionary regimes. This question about, I think you guys have done, Yep is one about imperialism. When I talk in the book about a model of global southern insurrection that shifts you from the urban proletariat to the rural poor, shifts the location of revolution very markedly from the industrialized West to places within and then post-empire. I mean, it's a very good question, and like most of good questions, when I don't know the answer, I tend to ask my students. The question, is there anything special about that mode of revolution? The one that occurs to me as a possibility is they are particularly international. I don't think the Cuban one is such a one-off in that regard, because the structure is fundamentally international. I know capitalism too, but there's something to that. The fact that it's over there that they're fighting as well as here gives you, I think, a sort of internationalist dimension that's fundamental to the project at large, that it's not easily nationalized, and it's not easily pressured into becoming the state bit of the revolutionary state. So that's my suspicion. The actors change, the forms of literature change, but I think the mode and expansiveness of internationalism.
I would like to remind everyone that the press has a stall outside. The book is available for purchase, and George will be signing copies of the book. And thank you to our participants.